Well, thank you, and thank you all for joining us here tonight. It's great to see the old place full. Jim mentioned the Michael Chabon event. We do have regular author events here, so those of you who are into books and reading, do sign up for our newsletter. We have a clipboard by the front thing, and you'll get all the notifications of that. Michael was our first guest, but by no means our last. We've had since then, we've had Pat Conroy, we've had Connie Willis, we've had Juno Diaz, we've had Ann Perry. You know, it's been a great and distinguished list of guests, and it's one that's just starting. Next week we have Joel Walton coming in, Hugo and Nebula award winning fantasist and science fiction coming in on Sunday. I promise not to mug her, even though she beat me for the Hugo Award. I don't think she'll actually have it with her, so she's probably safe. Joe is traveling the country doing a tour by train, taking advantage of Amtrak's offer that they made a few months ago that some of you may have heard of, that writers ride free on Amtrak. So that's kind of cool. So anyway, Joe will come, and all of our author events are like free admission if you buy a hardcover book, $5 if you buy a paperback, and $10 if you don't buy anything. It's funny that you should start with Steve Ditko's son. That's amazing that Steve Ditko's son is old enough to retire. I was the first words of mine ever published were in Stanley and Jack Kirby, a letter of comment in Fantastic Four number 20, saying, because I was a young little comics fan in Bayonne, New Jersey, and I said, basically, Shakespeare better move over because Stan Lee had arrived. But I did later also have letters to Stan and Steve in the letter column of Spider-Man and in Avengers and in X-Men. I wrote to all of those comics. I just loved loved the Marvel comic. And in 1964, they had the first comic book convention. Some of you may have heard of Comic Cons. They have one in San Diego that now draws 150,000 people. The first one was in Greenwich Village in a room about the size of this one, smaller actually, had about 30 people. And I was the first one to sign up for it. So I'm the first comic fan, I guess, officially. And the guest of honor at that, the biggest comic book professional who came to that convention to meet with these 30 grubby fans, almost all of us high school kids, was Steve Ditko. And he's never been back, so I think we didn't leave a very good impression on him. Anyway, they've asked me to do a reading, so I have my new book here, Rogues. Which just came out yesterday, as a matter of fact. So I'm going to read from that. And we have copies here if any of you want it. And you'll see out in the room we have copies of a lot of books from our author events. We're, in addition to being a movie theater, we're like the world's most exclusive bookstore. All of our books are autographed by people who have come here. So we do have titles by Juno Diaz and Ann Perry and Pat Conroy and one or two left from Michael Chabon from when he was here, although not many. I think we may be out of Cavalier and Clay. We have to get him back to sign some more of those. Rogues is an anthology edited by myself and Gardner Dozois. It's a cross-genre anthology. You know, I'm known, of course, mostly for fantasy these days, for A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones. In an earlier part of my career, I was known as a horror writer for things like Fever Dream and Armageddon Rag, the skin trade. Still earlier, I was known as a science fiction writer, all the subsets of imaginative literature. And indeed, I've loved them all since I was a kid, and comic books too. Witness my wildcard series that I've been editing low these many years. But although I write primarily in these genres, I read very widely. Growing up in Bayonne, New Jersey, and buying those comic books, and then graduating to books that actually had no pictures in them, we had no bookstores in Bayonne, New Jersey. Not a one. And what we had were spinner racks, wire spinner racks in what we called candy stores. These days you'd call them bodegas or something like that. They weren't like chocolatier shops like some people think when they hear candy stores. For us in the East Coast, candy store had everything. It had candy, but it also had magazines. It had groceries. Some of them had a soda fountain. Some of them had deli meats. There were all sorts of things. And this one on Kelly Parkway and First Street in Bayonne had this spinner rack, and that's where I bought my books. Now, the thing about the spinner rack was that it was not organized. It was not like a bookstore where there are sections, and all the books were mixed up together. So, you know, you would have James Joyce next to Robert A. Heinlein. You would have a collection of Shakespeare's plays next to Norman Vincent Peale's latest book, or, you know, and I was looking for the science fiction fantasy, but I would find, like, Raymond Chandler, and they had all the mystery novels with for the 50s, incredibly sexy covers, the film noir covers, those always caught my eye. You know, you would have westerns, Louis L'Amour, you know, everything was mixed up together. And I look back on that, and that was great, because whenever a cover caught my eye, regardless of what genre it was, even if it was not fiction or nonfiction, there was history in there too, I would pick it up and buy it home, and it made my readings much broader. These days, in the days of the superstores and Amazon, everything is organized by genre and category, and people who are fantasy fans of mine, they go right into the bookstore and they go right to the fantasy section. They see what's in the fantasy section. They don't even see the rest of the store. And they're missing out on a lot of good writers. And similarly, the Western fans, the mystery fans, the people reading literary fiction, the people who just come in the front and read that bestseller section. They're reading in a very narrow parameter. So with these anthologies, Gardner, Dozois, and I, my co-editors, set out to kind of restore the spinner rack. We would get a very broad theme. The first one we did a few years ago was called Warriors. But we got science fiction and fantasy writers. But we also got mystery writers and historical fiction writers and romance writers and literary fiction writers and writers from all sorts. It's just one word, warriors. Give me a story about a warrior. And they did, and we put together anthology. And it was very successful. We followed it up with Dangerous Women, which we have copies of somewhere. Similar theme. And this one, Rogues, the latest one out, which of course is about rogues and scalawags and ne'er-do-wells, and we have mystery stories in here and historical fiction and science fiction, fantasy, of course, a broad mix of writers by many different genres. And I'm in it myself with a story called The Rogue Prince, and I'm going to read you a little bit of that. It's a kind of unusual story, because what it is fake history. You know, one of the big things about fantasy is world building. And not only are you telling the story, but you're creating an entire secondary world, as J.R. Tolkien called it, with its own history and its own geography and its own legends and its own gods and religions. And the depth and the verisimilitude of that world building is one of the things by which fantasy fiction is judged. Tolkien set a very high bar for the rest of us to follow. I don't think anyone will ever equal Tolkien in his world building, because to Tolkien, world building was all that mattered. He worked on the Silmarillion from his days in the trenches of World War I to his death in the 70s. Never completed it, actually. It was left to his son to put it together. And that was the basis of things like Lord of the Rings. He was far more interested in the legends and the myths and the languages. You know, he invented two completely different elven languages and a dwarfish language and so forth. And that's been a daunting task for those of us who follow, who are not world-class linguists. I remember after my book started coming out, I got a letter from one fan who said, I'm fascinated by your language, High Valyrian. I want to put together, write an article about High Valyrian. Could you send me your vocabulary and some rules of the syntax and how High Valyrian works? And I wrote back, you seem to have mistaken me for J.R. Tolkien. Yes, he invented two entirely Elvish languages. I have invented seven words of High Valyrian. And when I need an eighth, I will invent that one. Oddly enough, as an aside here, oddly enough, the show needed High Valyrian and needed Dothraki when we went forward, because I could just write, and then the actor said in High Valyrian, but when you have that actor, he actually has words to say. So they hired a language creation guy who has now created High Valyrian. So now writing my own books, I have to consult someone else and his syntax and all that. But another part of world building, of course, is the history, the kings and all that, and Tolkien set the bar for that too. And as my series went forward, I had glancing references here and there to, the previous kings, the kings of 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 300 years ago, to events that had happened in the past of Westeros. And I started getting all this interest from fans writing me, asking more questions about this. And unlike Tolkien, I hadn't spent 20 years working on this history before I started writing books. But there was such demand for it, we decided we would put together a concordance book. And it's called The World of Ice and Fire. And that's going to be out in October. And what I did is I got these two fans of mine, Elio Garcia and Linda Antonsen. Elio's an American who lives in Sweden with Linda, who's his Swedish girlfriend. And they run the Westeros site. And they know more about Westeros than I do. And I said, okay, I'll partner with them so it won't distract me too much from writing novels. And Elio and Linda went through the book, and they pulled out every reference I'd made to the past and to the legends and to previous kings, and they organized it all, and they put it all together. And then I was going to take that over, smooth it out, polish it, fill in some holes, because there were certain kings that had hardly been discussed at all. So it was a good continuous narrative, and my publisher was very interested in doing that. And they contracted us to do this book, The World of Ice and Fire, and the idea is that it would be a coffee table, big oversized coffee table book with lavish art, lavishly illustrated by fantasy illustrators, some of the best fantasy artists in the world, including Jay Drummond, whose art show is, I don't know if it's up yet. Is it up in the... If not, it'll be up tomorrow. She's one of our illustrators for The World of Ice and Fire. And because of we're going to have so much art in this book, the text would be rather small. It would be 50,000 words of history, you know, what they put together and what I polished. So Ilya and Linda took their past. They pulled out the things. They did their part of it. They wrote their histories, attached queries where there were holes, and they delivered 70,000 words of the 50,000 we were supposed to do. And then I took over, and I added 300,000 words. of fake history. And, of course, when I delivered it, I wasn't even done yet. I mean, I hadn't even covered all the kings. I would have been another 300,000 words to get up to the, quote, present. And my editor said, George, this isn't going to work. You know, this is supposed to be a coffee table book with art on every page here. You've given them so much text here that we're going to have, like, art every 10 pages. It's going to... So I ripped all that stuff out, basically. And we went back to kind of the original concept. But now I had all these hundreds of thousands of pages of fake history. So we're going to do yet another book years from now when I finish that, which I've jokingly been calling the Grimmarillion, since it's my parallel to Tolkien's Silmarillion. But when we started doing these anthologies, of course, they wanted a story from me. I don't have time to write a story. But, you know, I do have all these 300,000 words of fake history, so I can give you a chunk of fake history. And I pulled out, for the Princess and the Queen, a chunk of the fake history from the Grimmarillion called For Dangerous Women, The Princess and the Queen, The Count of the Dance of the Dragons. And that was very successful. People seemed to like it a lot. So for Rogues, I did similar, and I pulled out something that actually comes right before The Princess and the Queen, which is what I'm going to read from The Rogue Prince. I do find the reception to this kind of odd because, You know, I know a lot of kids who hate history and young readers and all that. And, oh, I never liked history. You have to memorize all those dates and all those names, English history. Everybody's named Henry and Edward, and it's all very confusing. But they love my fake history, which has fake names and dates about kings who never lived and never happened. And the names are all much more complicated than Edward or Henry. But there you are. So this is actually supposedly not me writing. Our conceit in these books is that they're being written by Maesters of the Citadel, which is the scholarly institution that keeps the history of Westeros. And like any scholars, the Maesters disagree with each other and feel free to comment and denigrate their sources and say, no, this can't possibly be true. And the Maester who's chronicling all these events, Maester Gildane, is drawing on a number of primary sources from the event, including a cleric named Septon Eustace, a scholar himself, the Grand Maester, the official court records, and also the memories of the court fool Mushroom, who was a hunchback dwarf who with a huge head, who nobody took very seriously, but he was present for everything, and he had scurrilous opinions on all that. So I hope, I don't know if we'll get that deep into it, but all this scandalous, sexy stuff is from Mushroom, and he probably made all of it up. You can't really trust Mushroom. Anyway, I'll give you a little bit of this. By the way, this book also has some really great stuff by other people in it. We have Gillian Flynn, Patrick Rothfuss, Joe Abercrombie. Neil Gaiman has contributed a Neverwhere story that people have been waiting for decades. David Ball, the historical novelist, has a wonderful piece about art. Rogues All. The Rogue Prince, or A King's Brother. A consideration of the early life, adventures, misdeeds, and marriages of Prince Daemon Targaryen, as set down by Archmaester Gildane of the Citadel of Old Town. He was the grandson of a king, the brother of a king, husband to a queen. Two of his sons and three of his grandsons would sit the Iron Throne, but the only crown that Daemon Targaryen ever wore was the crown of the Stepstones, a meager realm he made himself with blood and steel and dragonfire, and soon abandoned. Over the centuries, House Targaryen has produced both great men and monsters. Prince Daemon was both. In his day, there was not a man so admired, so beloved, and so reviled in all of Westeros. He was made of light and darkness in equal parts. To some, he was a hero. To others, the blackest of villains. No true understanding of that most tragic bloodletting known as the Dance of the Dragons is possible without a consideration of the crucial role played before and during the conflict by this rogue prince. The seeds of this great conflict were sown during the last years in the long reign of the old king, Jaehaerys the First Targaryen. Of Jaehaerys himself, little need be said here, save that after the passing of his beloved wife, good Queen Alysanne, and his son Baelon, Prince of Dragonstone, Hand of the King and heir apparent to the Iron Throne, his grace was but a shell of the man that he had been. With Prince Baelon lost to him, the old king had to turn elsewhere for a partner in his labors. As his new hand, he called upon Sir Otto Hightower, younger brother to Lord Hightower of Old Town. Sir Otto brought his wife and children to court with him and served King Jaehaerys faithfully for the years remaining to him. As the king's strength and wits began to fail, he was oft confined to bed. Sir Otto's 15-year-old daughter, Alicent, became his constant companion, fetching his grace's meals, reading to him, helping him to bathe and dress himself. The old king sometimes mistook her for one of his daughters, calling her by their names. Near the end, he grew certain that she was his daughter Sarah, returned for him from beyond Narrow Sea. In the year 103 A.C., King Jaehaerys I Targaryen died in his bed, as Lady Alicent was reading to him from Septon Barth's Unnatural History. His grace was 69 years of age and had reigned over the Seven Kingdoms since coming to the Iron Throne at the age of 14. His remains were burned in the Dragon Pit, his ashes interred with good Queen Alysanne's beneath the Red Keep. All of Westeros mourned. Even in Dorne, where his writ had not extended, men wept and women tore their garments. In accordance with his own wishes and the decision of the Great Council of 101, his grandson Viserys succeeded him, mounting the Iron Throne as King Viserys I Targaryen. At the time of his ascent, King Viserys was 26 years old. He had been married for a decade to a cousin, Lady Aemma of House Arryn, herself a granddaughter of the old king and good Queen Alicent through her mother, the late Princess Daela, died 82 A.C. Lady Aemma had suffered several miscarriages and a death of one son in the cradle, but she had also given birth to a healthy daughter, Rhaenyra, born 97 A.C. The new king and his queen both doted on the girl, their only living child. Viserys I Targaryen had a generous, amiable nature, and was well loved by lords and small folk alike. The reign of the young king, as the commons called him upon his ascent, would be peaceful and prosperous. His grace's open-handedness was legendary, and the Red Keep became a place of song and splendor. King Viserys and Queen Aemon hosted many a feast and tourney, and lavished gold, offices, and honors on their many favorites. At the center of this merriment, cherished and adored by all, was Princess Rhaenyra, the little girl the court singers soon dubbed the Realm's Delight. Though only six when her father came to the Iron Throne, Rhaenyra was a precocious child, bright and bold and beautiful as only one of dragon's blood can be beautiful. At the age of seven, she became a dragon rider, taking to the sky atop the young dragon she named Syrax, after a goddess of old Valyria. At eight, like many another highborn girl, the princess was placed into service as a cupbearer, but for her own father, the king. At table, at tourney, and at court, King Viserys thereafter was seldom seen without his daughter by his side. Meanwhile, the tedium of rule was left largely to the king's small council, and his hand, Sir Otto Haltire, had continued in that office, serving the grandson as he had the father, an able man, all agreed, though many found him proud, brusque, and haughty. The longer he served, the more imperious Sir Otto became, it was said, and many great lords and princes came to resent his manner and envy him his access to the Iron Throne. The greatest of his rivals was our rogue prince, Daemon Targaryen, the king's ambitious, impetuous younger brother. As charming as he was hot-tempered, Prince Daemon had earned his knight spurs at 6 and 10, and had been given Dark Sister by the old king himself in recognition of his prowess. Though he had wed the Lady of Runestone in 97 A.C. during the old king's reign, the marriage had not been a success. Prince Daemon found the Vale of Arryn boring. In the Vale, men fuck sheep, he wrote. You cannot fault them. Their sheep are prettier than their women. He soon developed a mislike of his lady wife, whom he called my bronze bitch, after the runic bronze armor worn by the lords of House Royce. Upon the accession of his brother to the Iron Throne, the prince petitioned to have his marriage set aside. Viserys denied the request, but did allow Daemon to return to court, where he sat on the small council, serving as master of coin from 103 to 104, and master of laws for half a year in 104. Governance bored this warrior prince, however. He did better when King Viserys made him commander of the city watch. Finding the watchmen ill-armed and clad in oddments and rags, Daemon equipped each man with a dirk, short sword, and cudgel, armored them in black ringmail with breastplates for the officers, and gave them long golden cloaks that they might wear with pride. Ever since, the men of the city watch have been known as the Gold Cloaks. Prince Daemon took eagerly to the work of the Gold Cloaks, and oft prowled the alleys of King's Landing with his men. That he made the city more orderly, no man could doubt, but his discipline was a brutal one. He delighted in cutting off the hands of pickpockets, gelding rapists, and slitting the noses of thieves, and slew three men in street brawls during his first year as commander. Before long, the prince was well known in all the low places of King's Landing. He became a familiar sight in wine sinks, where he drank for free, and gambling pits, where he always left with more coin than when he entered. Though he sampled countless whores in the city's brothels and was said to have a special fondness for deflowering maidens, a certain Lycian dancing girl soon became his favorite. Missaria was the name she went by, though rivals and enemies called her Misery, the White Worm. As King Viserys had no living son, Damon regarded himself as the rightful heir to the throne and coveted the title Prince of Dragonstone, which his grace refused to grant him. But by the end of the year 105 AC, he was known to his friends as Prince of the City and to the small folk as Lord Fleabottom. Though the king did not wish Damon to succeed him, he remained fond of his younger brother and was quick to forgive his many offenses. Princess Rhaenyra was also enamored of her uncle, for Damon was ever attentive to her. Whenever he crossed the narrow sea upon his dragon, he brought her back some exotic gift on his return. King Viserys never claimed another dragon after Balerion's death, nor did he have much taste for the joust, the hunt, or swordplay, whereas Prince Damon excelled in these spheres and seemed all that his brother was not, lean and hard, a renowned warrior, dashing, daring, more than a little dangerous. Though the origins of the enmity are much disputed, all men agree that Sir Otto Hightower, the king's hand, took a great mislike to the king's brother. The king's fool Mushroom asserts that the quarrel began when Prince Damon deflowered Sir Otto's young daughter Alicent, the future queen, but this scurrilous tale is unsupported by any other source. It was Sir Otto who convinced Viserys to remove Prince Damon as master of coin and then as master of laws, actions he soon came to regret. As commander of the city watch, with 2,000 men under his command, Damon waxed more powerful than ever. On no account can Prince Damon be allowed to ascend to the Iron Throne, the hand wrote his brother, the Lord of Oldtown. He would be a second Maegor the Cruel, or worse. It were Sir Otto's wish, then, that Princess Rhaenyra succeed her father. Better the realm's delight than Lord Fleabottom, he wrote. Nor was he alone in this opinion. Yet his party faced a formidable hurdle. If the precedent set by the Great Council of 101 was followed, a male claimant must prevail over a female. In the absence of a true-born son, the king's brother would come before the king's daughter, as Balon had come before Rhaenys in 92 AC. As for the king's views, all the chronicles agree that King Viserys hated dissension. Though far from blind to his brother's flaws, he cherished his memories of the free-spirited, adventurous boy that Damon had been. His daughter was his life's great joy, he oft said, but a brother is a brother. Time and time again he strove to make peace between Prince Damon and Sir Otto, but the enmity between the two men roiled endlessly beneath the false smiles they wore at court. When pressed upon the matter, King Viserys would only say that he was certain his queen would soon present him with his son. And in 105 AC, he announced to the court and small council that Queen Aemma was once again with child. During the same faithful year, Sir Criston Cole was appointed to the Kingsguard to fill the place created by the death of the legendary Sir Ryan Redwine. Born the son of a steward in service to Lord Dundarrion of Blackhaven, Sir Criston was a comely young knight of 23 years. He first came to the attention of the court when he won the melee held at Maidenpool in honor of King Viserys' accession. In the final moments of the fight, Sir Criston knocked Dark Sister from Prince Damon's hand with his Morning Star, to the delight of the grace and the fury of the prince. Afterward, he gave 7-year-old Princess Rhaenyra the victor's laurel and begged for her favor to wear in the joust. In the lists, he defeated Prince Damon once again and unhorsed both of the celebrated Cargyle twins, Sir Arryk and Sir Eric, before falling to Lord Lyman Manister. With his pale green eyes, coal black hair, and easy charm, Cole soon became a favorite of all the ladies at court, not least among them Rhaenyra Targaryen herself. So smitten was she by the charms of the man she called My White Knight, that Rhaenyra begged her father to name Sir Criston her own personal shield and protector. His grace indulged her in this, as in so much else. Thereafter, Sir Criston always wore her favor in the lists and became a fixture at her side during feasts and frolics. Not long after Sir Criston donned his white cloak, King Viserys invited Lionel Strong, Lord of Harrenhal, to join the small council as master of law. A big man, burly and balding, Lord Strong enjoyed a formidable reputation as a battler. Those who did not know him oft took him for a brute, mistaking his silences and slowness of speech for stupidity. This was far from the truth. Lord Lionel had studied at the Citadel as a youth, earning 6 links of his chain before deciding that a maester's life was not for him. He was literate and learned, his knowledge of the laws of the Seven Kingdoms exhaustive. Thrice wed and thrice a widower, the Lord of Harrenhal brought 2 maiden daughters and 2 sons to court with him. The girls became handmaids to Princess Rhaenyra, watch their elder brother, Sir Harwin Strong, called Breakbones, was made a captain in the Gold Cloaks. The younger boy, Laris de Clubfoot, joined the king's confessors. Thus did matters stand in King's Landing late in the year 105, when Queen Aemma was brought to bed in Maker's Holdfast and died while giving birth to the son that Viserys Targaryen had desired for so long. The boy, named Balon after his king's father, survived her by only a day, leaving the king and court bereft, save perhaps for Prince Daemon, who was observed in a brothel on the Street of Silk, making drunken japes with his highborn cronies about the heir for a day. When word of this got back to the king, legend said it was the whore sitting in Daemon's lap who informed him, but evidence suggests that it was actually one of his drinking companions, a captain in the Gold Cloaks, eager for advancement. Viserys became livid. His grace finally had had a surfeit of his ungrateful brother and his ambitions. Once his mourning had run its course, the king moved swiftly to resolve the long simmering issue of the succession. Disregarding the precedents set by King Jaehaerys in 92 and a great council in 101, King Viserys I declared his daughter Rhaenyra to be his rightful heir and named her Princess of Dragonstone. In a lavish ceremony at King's Landing, hundreds of lords did obeisance to Rhaenyra as she sat at her father's feet at the base of the Iron Throne, swearing to honor and defend her right of succession. And I better stop there, but there's lots more. If you want to find out the rest, of the stories in Rogues, and the follow-up story to Princess and the Queen is in Dangerous Women. And all the rest of the 300,000 words will eventually be in the Grimmarillion, but that's going to be years till that one comes out. And we have shortened versions of this in The World of Ice and Fire, the big coffee table book, which is still coming out in October and still has a lot of cool stuff in it, but not nearly as much as I wrote.